This has turned to shit. Jonathan led him to a small sitting room. There was a fire burning in the hearth. The heat felt good after a day long tromping through the cold and the rain. The furnishings were antique, or maybe just old. Willie wasn't too clear on the difference. Stephen had preceded them. Two brandy snifters, half full of amber liquid, sat on a low table. Stephen squatted by the fire, his tall, lean body folded up like a jackknife. He looked up as they entered and stared at Willie a moment too long, as if he'd suddenly forgotten who he was or what he was doing there. Then his flat blue eyes went back to the fire, and he took no more notice of them or their conversation. Willie looked around for the most comfortable chair and sat in it. The style reminded him of Randy Wade, but that just made him feel guilty. He picked up his cognac. Willie was couth enough to know that he was supposed to sip, but cold and tired and pissed off enough so that he didn't care. He emptied it in one long swallow, put it down on the floor, and relaxed back into the chair as the heat spread through his chest. Jonathan, obviously in some pain, lowered himself carefully into the edge of the couch. His hands closed around the head of his walking stick. Willie found himself staring. Jonathan noticed. "A wolf's head," he said. He moved his hands aside to give Willie a clear view, the firelight reflecting off the rich yellow metal. The beast was snarling, snapping. Its eyes were red. "Garnets?" Willie guessed. Jonathan smiled the way you might smile at a particularly doltish child. "Rubies," he said, "set in 18-carat gold." His hands, large and heavily veined, twisted by arthritis, closed round the stick again, hiding the wolf from sight. "Stupid," Willie said. "There's guys in this city would kill you as soon as look at you for a stick like that." Jonathan's smile was humorless. "I will not die on account of gold, William." He glanced at the window. The moon was well above the horizon. "A good hunter's moon," he said. He looked back at Willie. "Last night you all but accused me of complicity in the death of the crippled girl." His voice was dangerously soft. "Why would you say such a thing?" "I can't imagine," Willie said. He felt light-headed. The brandy had rushed right to his mouth. "Maybe the fact that you can't remember her name had something to do with it, or maybe it was because you always hated Journey, right from the moment you heard about her. My pathetic little mongrel bitch, I believe that was what you called her. Isn't it funny the way that little turns of phrase stick in the mind?" "I don't know. Maybe it was just me. But somehow I got this impression that you didn't exactly wish her well. I haven't even mentioned Stephen yet." "Please don't," Jonathan said icily. "You've said quite enough. Look at me, William. Tell me what you see." "You," said Willie. He wasn't in the mood for asshole games. But Jonathan Harmon did things at his own pace. "An old man," Jonathan corrected. "Perhaps not so old in years alone, but old nonetheless. The arthritis grows worse every year, and there are days when the pain is so bad I can hardly move. My family is all gone but for Stephen, and Stephen, let us be frank, is not all that I might have hoped for in a son." He spoke in firm, crisp tones, but Stephen did not even look up from the flames. "I'm tired, William, it's true. I did not approve of your crippled girl, or even particularly of you. We live in a time of corruption and degeneracy, when the old truths of blood and iron have been forgotten. Nonetheless, however much I may have loathed your Joan Sorensen and what she represented, I had no taste of her blood. All I want is to live out my last years in peace." Willie stood up. "Do me a favor and spare me the old sick man act. Yeah, I know all about your arthritis and your war wounds. I also know who you are and what you're capable of. Okay, you didn't kill Journey, so who did? Him?" He jerked a thumb towards Stephen. "Stephen was here with me." "Maybe he was and maybe he wasn't," Willie said. "Don't flatter yourself, Flambeau. You're not important enough for me to lie to you. Even if your suspicion was correct, My son is not capable of such an act. Must I remind you that Stephen is crippled as well in his own way?" Willie gave Stephen a quick glance. "I remember once when I was just a kid, my father had come to see you, and he brought me along. I used to love to ride in your little cable car. Him and you went inside to talk, but it was a nice day, so you let me play outside. I found Stephen in the woods, playing with some poor sick mutt that had gotten past your fence. He was holding it down with his foot, and pulling off its legs, one by one, just ripping them out with his bare hands like a normal kid might pull petals off a flower. When I walked up behind him, he had two off and was working on the third. There was blood all over his face. He couldn't have been more than 8. Jonathan Harmon sighed. "My son is disturbed. We both know that, so there is no sense in my denying it. He is also dysfunctional, as you know full well, and whatever residual strength remains is controlled by his medication. He has not had a truly violent episode for years, have you, Stephen?" Stephen Harmon looked back at them. The silence went on too long as he stared, unblinking, at Willie. "No," he finally said. Jonathan nodded with satisfaction, as if something had been settled. "So you see, William, you do us a great injustice. What you took for a threat was only an offer of protection. I was going to suggest that you move to one of our guest rooms for a time. I've made the same suggestion to Zoe and Amy." Willie laughed. "I'll bet. Do I have to fuck Stephen too, or is that just for the girls?" Jonathan flushed, but kept his temper. His futile efforts to marry off Stephen to one of the Anders sisters was a sore spot. "I regret to say they declined my offer. I hope you will not be so unwise. Blackstone has certain protections, but I cannot vouch for your safety beyond these walls." "Safety?" Willie said. "From what?" "I do not know, but I can tell you this. In the dark of the night there are things that hunt the hunters." "Things that hunt the hunters," Willie repeated. "That's good. Has a nice beat, but you can dance to it." He'd had enough. He started for the door. "Thanks, but no thanks. I'll take my chances behind my own walls." Stephen made no move to stop him. Jonathan Harmon leaned more heavily on his cane. "I can tell you how she was really killed," he said quietly. Willie stopped and stared into the old man's eyes. Then he sat back down. "It was on the south side, in a neighborhood that made the flats look classy, on an elbow of land between the river and that old canal that ran past the pack. Algae and raw sewage choked the canal and gave off a smell that drifted for blocks. The houses were single-story, clapboard affairs, hardly more than shacks. Randy hadn't been down here since the pack had closed its doors. Every third house had a sign on the lawn, flapping forlornly in the wind, advertising a property for sale or for rent, and at least half of those were dark. Weeds grew waist-high around the weathered rural mailboxes, and they saw at least 2 burnt-out lots. Years had passed, and Randy didn't remember the number, but it was the last house on the left, she knew, next to a Sinclair station on the corner. The cabbie cruised until they found it. The gas station was boarded up, even the pumps were gone, but the house stood there, much as she recalled it. It had a for rent sign on the lawn, but she saw a light moving around inside. A flashlight, maybe. It was gone before she could be sure. The cabbie offered to wait. "No," she said. "I don't know how long I'll be." After he was gone, she stood on the barren lawn for a long time, staring at the front door, before she finally went up the walk. She decided not to knock, but the door opened as she was reaching for the knob. "Can I help you, miss?" He loomed over her, a big man, thick-bodied but muscular. His face was unfamiliar, but he was no Hellander. They had been short, wiry family, all with the same limp, dirty blonde hair. This one had black hair, as wrought iron, and shaggier than the department usually liked. 5 o'clock shadow gave his jaw a distinct blue-black cast. His hands were large with short, blunt fingers. Everything about him said cop. I was looking for the people who used to live here. The family moved away when the pack closed, he told her. Why don't you come inside? He opened the door wider. Randy saw bare floors, dust, and his partner, a beer-bellied black man standing by the door to the kitchen. I don't think so, she said. I insist, he replied. He showed her a gold badge pinned to the inside of his cheap grey suit. Does that mean I'm under arrest? He looked taken aback. No, of course not. We'd just like to ask you a few questions. He tried to sound friendlier. I'm Rogoff. Homicide? She said. His eyes narrowed. How? You're in charge of the Sorensen investigation, she said. She'd been given his name at the cop house that morning. You must not have much of a case if you've got nothing better to do than hang around here waiting for Roy Hellander to show. We were just leaving. Thought maybe he'd get nostalgic, hole up at the old house, but there's no sign of it. He looked at her hard and frowned. Mind telling me your name? Why? She asked. Is this a bust or a come-on? He smiled. I haven't decided yet. I'm Randy Wade. He showed him her license. Private detective, he said, his tone carefully neutral. He handed the license back to her. You working? She nodded. Interesting. I don't suppose you'd care to tell me the name of your client?
No.
I could haul you into court, make you tell the judge. You can get that license lifted, you know. Obstructing an ongoing police investigation, withholding evidence. Professional privilege, she said. Rogoff shook his head. PIs don't have privilege, not in this state. This one does, Randy said. Attorney-client relationship. I've got a law degree, too. She smiled at him sweetly. Leave my client out of it. I know a few interesting things about Roy Hellander I might be willing to share. Rogoff digested that. I'm listening. Randy shook her head. Not here. You know the automat on Courier Square? He nodded. 8 o'clock, she told him. Come alone. Bring a copy of the coroner's report on Sorensen. Most girls want candy or flowers, he said. The coroner's report, she repeated firmly. They still keep the old case records downtown? Yeah, he said. Basement of the courthouse. Good. You can stop by and do a little remedial reading on the way. It was 18 years ago. Some kids had been turning up missing. One of them was Roy's little sister. There were others. Stansky, Jones. I forget all the names. A cop named Frank Wade was in charge of the investigation. A gold badge like you. He died. You're saying there's a connection? You're the cop. You decide. She left him standing in the doorway and walked briskly down the block. Stephen didn't bother to see him down to the foot of the bluffs. Willie rode the little funicular railway alone, morose and lost in thought. His joints ached like nobody's business and his nose was running. Every time he got upset his body fell to pieces, and Jonathan Harmon had certainly upset him. That was probably better than killing him, which he'd half expected when he found Stephen in his car, but still. He was driving home along 13th Street when he saw the bar's neon sign on his right. Without thinking, he pulled over and parked. Maybe Harmon was right, and maybe Harmon had his ass screwed on backwards, but in any case, Willie still had to make a living. He locked up the caddy and went inside. It was a slow Tuesday night, and Squeaky's was empty. It was a working man's tavern. 2 pool tables, a shuffleboard machine in back, booths along one wall. Willie took a bar stool. The bartender was an old guy, hard and dry as a stick of wood. He looked mean. Willie considered ordering a banana de curry just to see what the guy would say, but one look at that sour, twisted old face cured the impulse, and he asked for a Boilermaker instead. "Ed working tonight?" he asked when the bartender brought the drinks. "Only works weekends," the man said. "But he comes in most nights, plays a little pool." "I'll wait," Willie said. The shot made his eyes water. He chased it down with a gulp of beer. He saw a payphone back by the men's room. When the bartender gave him his change, he walked back, put in a quarter, and dialed Randy. She wasn't home. He got her damned machine. Willie hated phone machines. They made life a hell of a lot more difficult for collection agents, that was for sure. He waited for the tone, left Randy an obscene message, and hung up. The men's room had a condom dispenser mounted over the urinals. Willie read the instructions as he took a leak. The condoms were intended for prevention of disease only, of course, even though the one dispenser by the left-hand slot was a French tickler. Maybe he ought to install one of these at home, he thought. He zipped up, flushed, washed his hands. When he walked back out into the tap room, two new customers stood over the pool table, chalking up queues. Willie looked at the bartender, who nodded. "One of you Ed Jerdica?" Willie asked. Ed wasn't the biggest. His buddy was as large and pale as Moby Dick, but he was big enough, with a real, stupid, mean look on his face. "Yeah?" "We need to talk about some money you owe." Willie offered him one of his cards. Ed looked at the hand, but made no effort to take the card. He laughed. "Get lost," he said. He turned back to the pool table. Moby Dick racked up the balls, and Ed broke. That was all right, if that was the way he wanted to play it. Willie sat back on the bar stool and ordered another beer. He'd get his money one way or the other. Sooner or later, Ed would have to leave, and then it would be his turn. Willie still wasn't answering his phone. Randy hung up the payphone and frowned. He didn't have an answering machine either, not Willie Flambeau. That would be too sensible. She knew she shouldn't worry. The hounds of hell don't punch time clocks, as he'd told her more than once. He was probably out running down some deadbeat. She'd try again when she got home. If he still didn't answer, then she'd start to worry. The automat was almost empty. Her heels made hollow clicks on the old linoleum as she walked back to her booth and sat down. Her coffee had gone cold. She looked idly out the window. The digital clock on the State National Bank said 8:13. Randy decided to give him 10 more minutes. The red vinyl of the booth was old and cracking, but she felt strangely comfortable here. Sipping her cold coffee and staring off at the iron spire across the square. The automat had been her favourite restaurant when she was a little girl. Every year, on her birthday, she would demand a movie at the castle and dinner at the automat, and every year her father would laugh and oblige. She loved to put the nickels in the coin slots and make the windows pop open, and fill her father's cup out of the old brass coffee machine with all its knobs and levers. Sometimes you could see disembodied hands through the glass, sticking a sandwich or a piece of pie into one of the slots, like something from an old horror movie. You never saw any people working at the automat, just hands. The hands of people who hadn't paid their bills, her father once told her, teasing. That gave her the shivers, but somehow made her annual visits even more delicious, in a creepy kind of way. The truth, when she learned it, was much less interesting. Of course, that was true of most everything in life. These days, the automat was always empty, which made Randy wonder how the floor could possibly stay so filthy. And you had to put quarters into the coin slots beside the little windows instead of nickels. But the banana cream pie was still the best she'd ever had, and the coffee that came out of those worn brass spigots was better than anything she ever brewed at home. She was thinking of getting a fresh cup when the door opened, and Rogoff finally came in out of the rain. He wore a heavy wool coat. His hair was wet. Randy looked out at the clock as he approached the booth. It said 8:17. "You're late," she said. "I'm a slow reader," he said. He excused himself and went to get some food. Randy watched him as he fed dollar bills into the change machine. He wasn't bad-looking, if you liked the type, she decided, but the type was definitely cop. Rogoff returned with a cup of coffee, the hot beef sandwich with mashed potatoes, gravy and overcooked carrots, and a big slice of apple pie. "The banana cream is better," Randy told him as he slid in opposite her. "I like apple," he said, shaking out a paper napkin. Did you bring the coroner's report?
In my pocket.
He started cutting up the sandwich. He was very methodical, slicing the whole thing into small, bite-sized portions before he took his first taste. I'm sorry about your father.
So was I. It was a long time ago.
Can I see the report?
Maybe.
Tell me something I don't know already about Roy Hellander.
Randy sat back.
We were kids together. He was older, but he'd been left back a couple of times till he wound up in my class. He was a bad kid from the wrong side of the tracks, and I was a cop's daughter, so we didn't have much in common, until his little sister disappeared.
He was with her, Rogoff said.
Yes, he was. No one disputed that, least of all Roy. He was 15, she was 8. They were walking the tracks. They went off together, and Roy came back alone. He had blood on his dungarees and all over his hands. His sister's blood.
Rogoff nodded.
All that's in the file. They found blood on the tracks, too. Three kids had already vanished. Jesse Hellander made four. The way most people looked at it, Roy had always been a little strange. He was solitary, inarticulate, used to hook school and run off to some secret hideout he had in the woods. He liked to play with the younger kids instead of boys his own age. A degenerate from a bad family, a child molester, who had actually raped and killed his own sister. That's what they said. They gave him all kinds of tests, decided he was deeply disturbed, and sent him away to some kiddie snake pit. He was still a juvenile, after all. Case closed, and the city breathed easier.
If you don't have any more than that, the coroner's report stays in my pocket, Rogoff said.
Roy said he didn't do it. He cried and screamed a lot, and his story wasn't coherent, but he stuck to it. He said he was walking along 10 feet or so behind his sister, balancing on the rails and listening for a train, when a monster came out of a drainage culvert and attacked her.
A monster? Rogoff said.
Some kind of big, shaggy dog, that was what Roy said. He was describing a wolf. Everybody knew it.
There hasn't been a wolf in this part of the country for over a century.
He described how Jessie screamed as the thing began to rip her apart. He said he grabbed her leg, tried to pull her out of its jaws, which would explain why he had blood all over him. The wolf turned and looked at him and growled. It had red eyes, burning red eyes, Roy said, and he was real scared, so he let go. By then, Jesse was almost certainly dead. It gave him one last snarl and ran off, carrying the body in its jaws. Randy paused and took a sip of coffee. That was his story. He told it over and over to his mother, the police, the psychologists, the judge, everyone. No one ever believed him.
Not even you.
Not even me. We all whispered about Roy in school, about what he'd done to his sister and those other kids. We couldn't quite imagine it, but we knew it had to be horrible. The only thing was, my father never quite bought it.
Why not?
She shrugged.
Instincts, maybe. He was always talking about how a cop had to go with his instincts. It was his case. He'd spent more time with Roy than anyone else. And something about the way the boy told the story had affected him. But it was nothing that could be proved. The evidence was overwhelming. So Roy was locked up.
She watched his eyes as she told him.
A month later, Eileen Stansky vanished. She was 6.
Rogoff paused with a forkful of the mashed potatoes and studied her thoughtfully.
Inconvenient, he said.
Dad wanted Roy released, but no one supported him. The official line was that the Stansky girl was unconnected to the others. Roy had done 4, and some other child molester had done the 5th.
It's possible.
It's bullshit, Randy said. Dad knew it, and he said it. That didn't make him any friends in the department, but he didn't care. He could be a very stubborn man.
You read the file on his death?
Rogoff nodded. He looked uncomfortable.
My father was savaged by an animal.
A dog, the coroner said. If you want to believe that, go ahead. This was the hard part.
She'd picked at it like an old scab for years, and then she'd tried to forget it, but nothing made it easier. He got a phone call in the middle of the night, some kind of lead about the missing kids. Before he left, he phoned Joe Urquhart to ask for backup. "Chief Urquhart?" Randy nodded. He wasn't chief then. Joe had been his partner when he was still in uniform. He said Dad told him he had a hot tip, but not the details, not even the name of the caller. Maybe he didn't know the name. He knew. My father wasn't the kind of cop who goes off alone in the middle of the night on an anonymous tip. He drove down to the stockyards by himself. It was waiting for him there. Whatever it was took 6 rounds and kept coming. It tore out his throat, and after he was dead, it ate him. What was left by the time Urquhart got there? Joe testified that when he first found the body, he wasn't even sure it was human. She told the story in a cool, steady voice, but her stomach was churning. When she finished, Rogoff was staring at her. He set down his fork and pushed his plate away. "Suddenly, I'm not very hungry anymore." Randy's smile was humorless. "I love our local press. There was a case a few years ago when a woman was kidnapped by a gang, held for 2 weeks. She was beaten, tortured, sodomized, raped hundreds of times. When the story broke, the paper said she'd been, quote, assaulted, unquote. It said my father's body had been mutilated. It said the same thing about Joan Sorensen. I've been told her body was intact." She leaned forward, looking hard into his dark brown eyes. "That's a lie." "Yes," he admitted. He took a sheet of paper from his breast pocket, unfolded it, passed it across to her. "But it's not the way you think." Randy snatched the coroner's report from his hand and scanned quickly down the page. The words blurred, refused to register. It wasn't adding up the way it was supposed to. "Cause of death, exsanguination." Somewhere, far away, Rogoff was talking. "It's a security building. Her apartment's on the 14th floor. No balconies, no fire escapes, and the doorman didn't see a thing. The door was locked. It was a cheap spring lock, easy to jimmy, but there was no sign of forced entry. The instrument of death was a blade at least 12 inches long, extremely sharp, slender and flexible. Perhaps a surgical instrument. Her clothing was all over the apartment, just ripped to hell, in tatters. In her condition, you wouldn't think she'd put up much of a struggle, but it looks like she did. None of the neighbours heard anything, of course. The killer chained her to her bed, naked, and went to work. He worked fast, knew what he was doing, but it still must have taken her a long time to die. The bed was soaked with her blood, through the sheets and mattress, right down to the box spring. Randy looked back at him, and the coroner's report slid from her fingers onto the Formica table. Rogoff reached over and took her hand. "Joan Sorensen wasn't devoured by any animal, Miss Wade. She was flayed alive and left to bleed to death. And the part of her that's missing is her skin." It was 12:15 when Willie got home. He parked the caddy by the pier. Ed Judica's wallet was on the seat beside him. Willie opened it, took out the money, counted. $79. Not much, but it was a start. He'd give half to Betsy this first time and credit the rest to Ed's account. Willie pocketed the money and locked the empty wallet in the glove box. Ed might need the driver's license. He'd bring it by Squeaky's over the weekend when Ed was on and talk to him about a payment schedule. Willie locked up the car and trudged wearily across the rain-slick cobbles to his front door. The sky above the river was dark and starless. The moon was up by now, he knew, hidden somewhere behind those black cotton clouds. He fumbled for his keys, buried down under his inhaler, his pillbox, a half dozen pairs of scissors, a handkerchief, and the miscellaneous other junk that made his coat pocket sag. After a long minute, he tried his pants pocket, found them, and started in on his locks. He slid the first key into his double deadbolt. The door opened slowly, silently. The pale yellow light from a street lamp filtered through the brewery's high, dusty windows, patterning the floor with faint squares and twisted lines. The hulks of rusting machines crouched in the dimness like great dark beasts. Willie stood in the doorway, keys in hand, his heart pounding like a trip hammer. He put the keys in his pocket, found his Primatene, and took a hit. The hiss of the inhaler seemed obscenely loud in the silence. He thought of Joni, of what happened to her. He could run, he thought. The Cadillac was only a few feet behind him, just a few steps. Whatever was waiting in there couldn't possibly be fast enough to get him before he reached the car. Yeah, hit the road, drive all night. He had enough gas to make Chicago. It wouldn't follow him there. Willie took the first step back, then stopped and giggled nervously. He had a sudden picture of himself sitting behind the wheel of his big lime-green chrome boat, grinding the ignition, grinding and grinding and flooding the engine as something dark and terrible emerged from inside the brewery and crossed the cobblestones behind him. That was silly. It was only in bad horror movies that the ignition didn't turn over, wasn't it? Wasn't it? Maybe he had just forgotten to lock up when he'd left for work that morning. He had a lot on his mind, a full day's work ahead of him, and a night of bad dreams behind. Maybe he'd just closed the fucking door behind him and forgotten about his locks. He never forgot about his locks, but maybe he had, just this once. Willie thought about changing. Then he remembered Joni and put the thought aside. He stood on one leg and pulled off a shoe, then the other. Water soaked through his socks. He edged forward, took a deep breath, moved into the darkened brewery as silently as he could, pulling the door shut behind him. Nothing moved. Willie reached down into his pocket, pulled out Mr. Scissors. It wasn't much, but it was better than bare hands. Hugging the thick shadows along the wall, he crossed the room and began to creep upstairs on unstockinged feet. The streetlight shone through the window at the end of the hall. Willie paused on the steps when his head came up to the level of the second-story landing. He could look up and down the hallway. All the office doors were shut. No light leaking underneath or through the frosted glass transoms. Whatever waited for him, waited in darkness. He could feel his chest constricting again. In another moment he'd need his inhaler. Suddenly he just wanted to get it over with. He climbed the final steps and crossed the hall in two long strides, threw open the door to his living room, and slammed on the lights. Randy Wade was sitting in his beanbag chair. She looked up, blinking, as he hit the lights. "You've startled me," she said. "I startled you." Willie crossed the room and collapsed into his lazy boy. The scissors fell from his sweaty palm and bounced on the hardwood floor. "Jesus H. Christ on a crutch, you almost made me lose control of my personal hygiene. What the hell are you doing here? Did I forget to lock the door?" Randy smiled. "You locked the door, and you locked the door, and then you locked the door some more. You're world class when it comes to locking doors, Flambeau. It took me 20 minutes to get in." Willie massaged his throbbing temples. "Yeah, well, with all the women who want this body, I have got to have some protection, don't I?" He noticed his wet socks, pulled one off, grimaced. "Look at this," he said. "My shoes are out in the street getting rained on, and my feet are soaking. If I get pneumonia, you get the doctor bills. Wade, you could have waited." "It was raining," she pointed out. "You wouldn't have wanted me to wait in the rain, Willie. It would have pissed me off, and I'm in a foul mood already." Something in her voice made Willie stop rubbing his toes to look up at her. The rain had plastered loose strands of light brown hair across her forehead, and her eyes were grim. You look like a mess, he admitted. I tried to make myself presentable, but the mirror in your ladies' room is missing.
It broke. There's one in the men's room.
I'm not that kind of girl, Randy said. Her voice was hard and flat. Willie, your friend Joan wasn't killed by an animal. She was flayed. The killer took her skin.
I know, Willie said, without thinking.
Her eyes narrowed. They were grey-green, large and pretty, but right now they looked as cold as marbles.
You know, she echoed.
Her voice had gone very soft, almost to a whisper, and Willie knew he was in trouble.
You give me some bullshit story and send me running all around town, and you know? Do you know what happened to my father, too? Is that it? It was just your clever little way of getting my attention.
Willie gaped at her. His second sock was in his hand. He let it drop to the floor.
Hey, Randy, give me a break, okay? It wasn't like that at all. I just found out a few hours ago. Honest. How could I know? I wasn't there. It wasn't in the paper.
He was feeling confused and guilty.
What the hell am I supposed to know about your father? I don't know jack shit about your father. All the time you worked for me, you mentioned your family maybe twice.
Her eyes searched his face for signs of deception. Willie tried to give his warmest, most trustworthy smile. Randy grimaced.
Stop it, she said wearily. You look like a used car salesman. All right, you didn't know about my father. I'm sorry. I'm a little wrought up right now, and I thought... She paused thoughtfully. Who told you about Sorensen?
Willie hesitated.
I can't tell you, he said. I wish I could. I really do. But I can't. You wouldn't believe me anyway.
Randy looked very unhappy. Willie kept talking.
Did you find out whether I'm a suspect? The police haven't called.
They've probably been calling all day. By now they may have an APB out on you. If you won't get a machine, you ought to try coming home occasionally, she frowned.
I talked to Rogoff from Homicide.
Willie's heart stopped, but she saw the look on his face and held up a hand.
No, your name wasn't mentioned by either of us. They'll be calling on everyone who knew her.
Probably. But it's just routine questioning. I don't think they'll be singling you out.
Good, Willie said. Well, look, I owe you one, but there's no reason for you to go on like this. I know it's not paying the rent, so...
So what? Randy was looking at him suspiciously.
Are you trying to get rid of me now, after you got me involved in the first place?
She frowned.
Are you holding out on me?
I think you've got that reversed, Willie said lightly. Maybe he could joke his way out of it.
You're the one who gets bent out of shape whenever I offer to help you shop for lingerie.
Cut the shit, Randy said sharply. She was not amused in the least, he could see that.
We're talking about the torture and murder of a girl who was supposed to be a friend of yours. Or has that slipped your mind somehow?
No, he said, abashed. Willie was very uncomfortable. He got up and crossed the room, plugged in the hot plate.
Hey, listen, you want a cup of tea? I got Earl Grey, Red Zinger, Morning Thunder. The police think they have a suspect, Randy said.
Willie turned to look at her.
Who?
Roy Hellander, Randy said.
Oh, boy, Willie said.
He'd been a PFC in Hamburg when the Hellander thing went down, but he'd had a subscription to the Courier to keep up on the old hometown, and the headlines had made him ill.
Are you sure?
No, she said. They're just rounding up the usual suspects. Roy was a great scapegoat last time. Why not use him again? First they have to find him, though. No one's really sure that he's still in the state, let alone the city.
Willie turned away, busied himself with hot plate and kettle. All of a sudden, he found it difficult to look Randy in the eye.
You don't think Hellander was the one who grabbed those kids?
Including his own sister?
Hell no. Jessie was the last person he'd ever hurt. She actually liked him. Not to mention that he was safely locked away when number 5 disappeared.
I knew Roy Hellander.
He had bad teeth and he didn't bathe often enough, but that doesn't make him a child molester. He hung out with younger kids because the older ones made fun of him. I don't think he had any friends. He had some kind of secret place in the woods where he'd go to hide when things got too rough. He... She suddenly stopped, and Willie turned toward her, a teabag dangling from his fingers. You thinking what I'm thinking? The kettle began to scream. Randy tossed and turned for over an hour after she got home, but there was no way she could sleep. Every time she closed her eyes, she would see her father's face, or imagine poor Joan Sorensen, tied to that bed as the killer came closer, knife in hand. She kept coming back to Roy Hellander, to Roy Hellander in his secret refuge. In her mind, Roy was still the gawky adolescent she remembered, his blonde hair lank and unwashed, his eyes frightened and confused as they made him tell the story over and over again. She wondered what had become of that secret place of his during all the years he'd been locked up and drugged in the state mental home. And she wondered if maybe sometimes he hadn't dreamed of it as he lay there in his cell. She thought maybe he had. If Roy Hellander had indeed come home, Randy figured she knew just where he was. Knowing about it and finding it were two different things, however. She and Willie had kicked it around without narrowing it down any. Randy tried to remember, but it had been so long ago, a whispered conversation in the schoolyard. A secret place in the woods, he'd said. A place where no one ever came that was his and his alone, hidden and full of magic. That could be anything. A cave by the river, a treehouse, even something as simple as a cardboard lean-to. But where were these woods? Outside the city were suburbs and industrial parks and farms. The nearest state forest was 40 miles north along the river road. If this secret place was in one of the city parks, you'd think someone would have stumbled on it years ago.
That is the end of track two.
Without more to go on, Randy didn't have a prayer of finding it. But her mind worried it like a pit bull with a small child. Finally, her digital alarm clock read 2:13, and Randy gave up on sleep altogether. She got out of bed, turned on the light, and went back to the kitchen. The refrigerator was pretty dismal, but she found a couple of bottles of Pabst. Maybe a beer would help put her to sleep. She opened a bottle and carried it back to bed. Her bedroom furnishings were a hodgepodge. The carpet was a remnant. The blonde chest of drawers was boring and functional, and the four-poster queen-size bed was a replica. But she did own a few genuine antiques. The massive wardrobe, the full-length clawfoot dressing mirror in its ornate wooden frame, and the cedar chest at the foot of the bed. Her mother always used to call it a hope chest. Did little girls still keep hope chests? She didn't think so. At least not around here. Maybe there were still places where hope didn't seem so terribly unrealistic, but this city wasn't one of them. Randy sat on the floor, put the beer on the carpet, and opened the chest. Hope chests were where you kept your future, all the little things that were part of the dreams they taught you to dream when you were a child. She hadn't been a child since she was 12. Since the night her mother woke her with that terrible, inhuman sound. Her chest was full of memories now. She took them out, one by one. Yearbooks from high school and college, bundles of love letters from old boyfriends, and even that asshole she'd married. Her school ring and her wedding ring. Her diplomas. The letters she'd won in track and girls softball. A framed picture of her. And her date at the senior prom. Way, way down at the bottom, buried under all the other layers of her life, was a Police 38. Her father's gun. The gun he emptied the night he died. Randy took it out and carefully put it aside. Beneath it was the book, an old three-ring binder with a blue cloth cover. She opened it across her lap.
The yellowed courier story on her father's death was scotch-taped to the first sheet of paper, and Randy stared at that familiar photograph for a long time before she flipped the page. There were other clippings. Stories about the missing children that she'd torn furtively from the courier back issues in the public library. Magazine articles about animal attacks, serial killers, and monsters. All sandwiched between the lined pages she'd filled with her meticulous 12-year-old's script. The handwriting grew broader and sloppier as she turned the pages. She'd kept up the book for years, until she'd gone away to college and tried to forget. She thought she'd done a pretty good job of that, but now, turning the pages, she knew that was a lie. You never forget. She only had to glance at the headlines, and it all came back to her in a sickening rush. Eileen Stansky, Jesse Hellander, Diane Jones, Gregory Corio, Erwin Weiss. None of them had ever been found, not so much as a bone or a piece of clothing. The police said her father's death was accidental, unrelated to the case he was working on. They'd all accepted that, the chief, the mayor, the newspaper, even her mother, who only wanted to get it all behind them and go on with their lives. Barry Shoemaker and Joe Urquhart were the last to buy in, but in the end, even they came around, and Randy was the only one left. Mere mention of the subject upset her mother so much that she finally stopped talking about it, but she didn't forget. She just asked her questions quietly, kept up her binder, and hid it every night in the bottom of the hope chest. For all the good it had done. The last 20-odd pages in the back of the binder were still blank. The blue lines on the paper faint with age. The pages were stiff as she turned them, and when she reached the final page, she hesitated. Maybe it wouldn't be there, she thought. Maybe she'd just imagined it. It made no sense anyway. He would have known about her father, yes, but their mail was censored, wasn't it? They'd never let him send such a thing. Randy turned the last page. It was there, just as she'd known it would be. She'd been a junior in college when it arrived. She'd put it all behind her. Her father had been dead for 7 years, and she hadn't even looked at her binder for 3. She was busy with her classes and her sorority and her boyfriends, and sometimes she'd had bad dreams, but mostly it was okay. She thought that maybe the adults had been right all along. It had just been some kind of animal. Some kind of animal. Then, one day, the letter had come. She opened it on the way to class, read it with her friends chattering beside her, laughed and made a joke, and stuck it away, all very grown up. But that night, when her roommate had gone to sleep, she took it out and turned on her tensor to read it again, and felt sick. She was going to throw it away, she remembered. It was just trash, a twisted product of a sick mind. Instead, she'd put it in the binder. The scotch tape had turned yellow and brittle, but the envelope was still white, with the name of the institution printed neatly in the left-hand corner. Someone had probably smuggled it out for him. The letter itself was scrawled on a sheet of cheap typing paper in block letters. It wasn't signed, but she'd known who it was from. Randy slid the letter out of the envelope, hesitated for a moment, and opened it. It was a werewolf. She looked at it, and looked at it, and looked at it. And suddenly she didn't feel very grown up anymore. When the phone rang, she nearly jumped a foot. Her heart was pounding in her chest. She folded up the letter and stared at the phone, feeling strangely guilty, as if she'd been caught doing something shameful. It was 2:53 in the morning. Who the hell would be calling now? If it was Roy Hellander, she thought she might just scream. She let the phone ring. On the fourth ring, her machine cut in. "This is AAA Wade Investigations. Randy Wade speaking.
I can't talk right now, but you can leave a message at the tone and I'll get back to you.
The tone sounded.
Hello,
said a deep male voice that was definitely not Roy Hellander. Randy put down the binder and snatched up the receiver.
Rogoff, is that you?
Yeah, he said. Sorry if I woke you. Listen, this isn't by the book, and I can't figure out a good excuse for why I'm calling you, except that I thought you ought to know.
Cold fingers crept down Randy's spine.
Know what?
We've got another one, he said.
Willie woke in a cold sweat.
What was that?
A noise, he thought, somewhere down the hall. Or maybe just a dream. Willie sat up in bed and tried to get a grip on himself. The night was full of noises. It could have been a tugboat on the river, a car passing by underneath his windows, anything. He still felt sheepish about the way he'd let his fear take over when he found his door open. He was just lucky he hadn't stabbed Randy with those scissors. He couldn't let his imagination eat him alive. He slid back down under the covers and rolled over onto his stomach, closed his eyes. Down the hall, a door opened and closed. His eyes opened wide. He lay very still, listening. He'd locked all the locks, he told himself. He'd walked Randy to the door and locked all his locks. The spring lock, the chain, the double deadbolt. He'd even lowered the police bar. No one could get in once the bar was in place. It could only be lifted from the inside. The door was solid steel. And the back door might as well be welded shut. It was so corroded and unmovable. If they broke a window, he would have heard the noise. There was no way, no way. He was just dreaming. The knob on his bedroom door turned slowly, clicked. There was a small metallic rattle as someone pushed at the door. The lock held. The second push was slightly harder, the noise louder. By then, Willie was out of bed. It was a cold night, his jockey shorts and undershirt small protection against the chill, but Willie had other things on his mind. He could see the key still sticking out of the keyhole, an antique key for a 100-year-old lock. The office keyholes were big enough to peek through. Willie kept the keys inside them just to plug up the drafts, but he never turned them, except tonight. Tonight, for some reason, he'd turned that key before he went to bed, and somehow felt a little more secure when he heard the tumblers click. And now, that was all that stood between him and whatever was out there. He backed up against the window, glanced out at the cobbled alley behind the brewery. The shadows lay thick and black beneath him. He seemed to recall a big green metal dumpster down below, directly under the window, but it was too dark to make it out. Something hammered at the door. The room shook. Willie couldn't breathe. His inhaler was on the dresser across the room, over by the door. He was caught in a giant's fist, and it was squeezing all the breath right out of him. He sucked in the air. The thing outside hit the door again. The wood began to splinter. Solid wood, 100 years old, but it split like one of your cheap-ass hollow-core modern doors. Willie was starting to get dizzy. It was going to be real pissed off, he thought giddily, when he finally got in here and found that his asthma had already killed him. Willie peeled off his undershirt, dropped it to the floor, hooked a thumb in the elastic of his shorts. The door shook and shattered, falling half away from its hinges. The next blow snapped it in two. His head swam from lack of oxygen. Willie forgot all about his shorts and gave himself over to the change. Bones and flesh and muscles shrieked in the agony of transformation. But the oxygen rushed into his lungs, sweet and cold, and he could breathe again. Relief shuddered through him, and he threw back his head and gave it voice.
It was a sound to chill the blood, but the dark shape picking its way through the splinters of his door did not hesitate, and neither did Willie. He gathered his feet up under him and leapt. Glass shattered all around him as he threw himself through the window, and the shards spun outward into the darkness. Willie missed the dumpster, landed on all fours, lost his footing, and slid 3 feet across the cobbles. When he looked up, he could see the shape above him, filling his window. Its hands moved, and he caught the terrible glint of silver. And that was all it took. Willie was on his feet again, running down the street faster than he'd ever run before. The cab let her off 2 houses down. Police barricades had gone up all around the house, a dignified old Victorian manor badly in need of fresh paint. Curious neighbours, heavy coats thrown on over pyjamas and bathrobes, lined grand view, whispering to each other and glancing back at the house. The flashes on the police cars lent a morbid avidity to their faces. Randy walked past them briskly. A patrolman she didn't know stopped her at the police barrier. "I'm Randy Wade," she told him. "Rogoff asked me to come down." "Oh," he said, and jerked a thumb back of the house. "He's inside, talking to the sister." Randy found them in the living room. Rogoff saw her, nodded, waved her off, and went back to his questioning. The other cops looked at her curiously, but no one said anything. The sister was a young-looking 40, slender and dark, with pale skin and a wild mane of black hair that fell half down her back. She sat on the edge of a sectional in a white silk teddy that left little to the imagination, seemingly just as indifferent to the cold air coming through the open door as she was to the lingering glances of the policeman. One of the cops was taking some fingerprints off a shiny black grand piano in the corner of the room.